The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest this week is Dr. David Sayin, who is the Regional Administrator for Medicare for California, Arizona, and Hawaii and other parts of the country. And he'll be discussing, well, you'll never guess it, Medicare. However, before we have Dr. Sayin on, today we are going to discuss everyone's favorite subject. Here's where you do the drum roll, boom, brrrrum, like that. It is taxes, because we're in the middle of tax season. And what we would like to do is cover the new rules that went into effect in 2014, talk about hazardous mistakes that you could make, which would cost you a small fortune in extra taxes. We do want to make you aware of changes in the tax laws and also help to make 2015 less taxing for you. And in the end, make better financial decisions and life choices, of course, goaling your retirement outcomes.
Anytime, John, that we begin to talk about taxes, we really have to talk about tax brackets because it's so important in terms of how you invest, what you do. Obviously, you earned income, whether it's from investments or from a business or from a salary, whatever it is, well, you owe the government some money. So the first place to start when we talk about taxes is there are three different tax brackets you need to be aware of because there are three different levels of taxation that are going to affect you. Now, the first one is the tax bracket. And we have two different brackets that are very important. One is the Bush era tax brackets, which are much lower. They're lower tax rates, and the Obama era tax rates. And once you move into the Obama era tax rates, you obviously are going to be paying more in taxes. So let's take a look at the first tax bracket you need to be aware of. If you are single in 2014, and you made over $405,100, you move from a 35% tax bracket to the 39.6% bracket. If you're married, well, that number is $457,600, in which you move into that 39.6. So the real key here, the first thing is know what your marginal tax bracket is, and they change once you reach a certain level. $405,100 if you're single, and $457,600 if you are married. Now, the next bracket has to do with the loss of itemized deductions. And this was something that wasn't explained to a lot of taxpayers. Everybody said, oh, okay, I don't make $454,000, so this isn't going to affect me. Wrong. You could lose your itemized deductions, you can lose out your exemptions, and you can pay additional investment taxes. And the next bracket is for phasing out of itemized deductions. If you are single and you make over $254,200, or if you are married and you make over $305,050, what happens is they take 3% of your adjusted gross income. That's the figure on the first page of your tax return at the very bottom. They take 3% of that number and subtract it from your itemized deductions. So by lowering your itemized deductions, you end up paying more taxes. And that same bracket also applies to the phase out of your exemption. So if you have kids, you know, you get an exemption for yourself, you get an exemption for your spouse if you're married, and you get one for each kid. Well, at that same level of income, $254,200 single, $305,050, they begin to phase out your exemptions. So if you're single, from $254,000 to $376,700, if you're over $376,000, you will lose all your exemptions for you, your spouse, and your children. If you're married, $305,050 to $427,550. In that bracket, they phase out all of your itemized deductions. Now, if that wasn't enough, there's another bracket you have to be concerned about. See, this is stuff they don't tell you. And that's whether you pay the 3.8% tax on interest, dividends, capital gains, annuity income, and rent. That's the 3.8% Obama tax. There's a different bracket for that. For that, if you're single making $200,000, you pay the 3.8% tax on your investment income and capital gains. If you're married, that figure is $250,000 for the 3.8. So you can see there, when it comes to taxes, tax planning, and tax mistakes, a lot of people, John, I think, got really surprised with Obamacare because the number that was thrown out, hey, if you make, originally, because they adjust these numbers by inflation, originally the number was 400,000 single, 450 if you're married, and you thought, okay, I don't make that much money, that's not going to affect me. That's not the case. You can lose your itemized deductions, you can lose all your exemptions, and you can pay additional investment taxes on your investment income and capital gains. So there's three tax brackets, one for your marginal income, one for losing your itemized deductions and exemptions, and another one for paying the investment Obamacare tax.
Have you ever noticed, Jim, this is all a big giant game? In other words, when these things are discussed from a public point of view, the president or the politicians will say, you're going to get blah, 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 and we're thinking of the family, yada, yada, yada. And then when you begin to look at what's actually going on, you know, devil's in the details in the actual law, it's not really what you thought it was going to be. The public is never made aware of these other numbers. You know, everybody knew the taxes went up, especially in the upper income brackets, but they left out the part about the loss of exemptions and deductions, the fact that things are more complex, the tax rates are much higher. When you lose deductions and exemptions, this is a real impact on your income. So it's all a game, and the thing is so complex, you can't tell at a glance exactly what's going on and how it's going to affect you. And after the president's State of the Union message, he wants another $1.2 trillion in new taxes, but after quite a big hullabaloo, and you can understand why, he recanted on taxing 529 college savings plans.
Yeah, it is amazing because you're right, John. When they passed the tax increases, the number that was thrown out, hey, look, if you're single and you're making under $400,000, no big deal. You're still under the old tax rates. Or if you're married, $450,000. But that wasn't the case. At $257,000, the number, you lose your exemptions, start to lose your exemptions, your itemized deductions. And at $200,000, $250,000, you start paying the Obamacare tax on investment income and capital gains. But the reason you want to know these numbers, because obviously if you make $200,000 and you're single, well, guess what? You may be in the Bush era tax bracket of 15% on dividends and capital gains, but now you're going to have to add the 3.8% Obama tax and $250,000 if you're married. If you make $257,000, you're going to start losing 3% of your adjusted gross income against your itemized deductions. You're going to start phasing out your exemptions. So the reason you want to know your marginal tax bracket, because obviously it determines how much you get to keep of your income that you earn, whether it's a salary, whether it's a business, or it's an investment. So knowing your marginal tax bracket impacts the type of investments you want to make when you're saving for retirement or you're wanting to live. It's more favorable, for example, to invest in stocks because they're still taxed at 15% or 18.6%, depending if you get hit with the Obama tax, or 20% if you're in the higher bracket. So you want to know that because the type of investments really determines the kind of returns. Because remember, when you have certain investments, they're taxable. And what you want to do, depending on your tax bracket, is make those investments that are taxed the least. You want to be like Warren Buffett and pay a lower tax bracket. So how much money that you're going to have at retirement, a lot of it is going to depend not only on your investment choices, but also what you're going to pay in taxes along the way.
All right, so now we know how the tax bracket game works. Let's move on to common tax traps, things that catch you unaware. One of these things that when you're doing the income tax, you suddenly go, oh my gosh, I didn't see that one coming. There are extra taxes, and you shouldn't become surprised by some of this stuff on April 15th.
Well, let's start with a new tax and filing form that goes into effect in 2014. And a lot of this is a result of Obamacare and requiring individuals to have health insurance. As everybody is well aware, you must have health insurance or have proof that you do. If you don't, you're going to get hit with an additional tax. Now, there's two new forms that are going to be filed for your 2014 tax return. It's 8962 and 8965. Now, 8962 is for people that claim a tax credit or get their coverage through a federal or state exchange. And if your income is higher than expected, you could be forced to pay some of the credit back. In other words, if you're a low-income individual, the government is going to subsidize some of your health care coverage. However, a lot of people have claimed this based on a certain level of income, and then they turn out their level of income is much higher. Guess what? You're going to have to pay some of that back. And that's why you have to file this form. Now, the IRS, God bless these guys, they said, hey, the first year it's confusing. If you have to pay some of this back, we're not going to charge a penalty this year. We may do that next year. The other form, 8965, is for people who qualify for exemptions to Obamacare and those who don't know how much tax they owe. In other words, for those people that may end up having to pay for tax, you didn't get any health care coverage, you didn't get on the health care exchange, you owe money, and we're going to get into that in terms of how much you owe.
So 2014, first year for new reporting rules and taxes related for Obamacare. And remember, we really have to point this out. This is changing on a year-by-year basis. These taxes are going up every single year. The annual fee for the first year is $95 per adult, $47.50 per child, or 1% of your household income. Now, for 2015, that's the year we're in, which will be what you file in 2016 on April 15th, it's $325 per adult, or $162.50 per child. For 2016, now it gets really staggering here, $695 per adult and $347.50 per child, maximum of $2,085. Now, the tax is cheaper quite often than the expense of government insurance. Remember, the goal of the whole game was to get everybody into a single-payer system. And if you watch, you're going to find out we're in an intermediate stage right here as this thing begins not to work, and then Congress will propose that we go to some kind of single-payer system. But right now, this is the catch that we're in right now, and it's two times or three times more expensive with large deductibles.
You know, the interesting thing about this, John, is this is going to be unpopular. It's going to catch a lot of people by surprise. You notice, for example, in 2014, it's $95 per adult, $47.50 per child. 2015, which you'll be filing in the year 2016, that $95 jumps to $325, and $47.50 per child jumps to $162.50. However, in 2016, it goes to $700 per adult, $347.50, but you're not going to know that to 2017 after the presidential election. Some very big escalating jumps that are going to kick in here going forward in terms of if you do not buy government health insurance.
It seems the law is becoming institutionalized, Jim. I mean, now we have official IRS forms for 2014. What are some of the other tax traps that we should be avoiding as this system, rather than getting simpler and more streamlined, is actually getting much more complex?
You know, the one, John, I think that catches a lot of people, and especially those that are generous, have a charitable heart, and it's sort of what I call the gotcha tax, is individuals making large charitable gifts. An example is, let's say you want to donate a piece of property to a church or a charity, art, or maybe some collectible items. Whenever you make a gift that's over $5,000, remember this figure, $5,000, you need to get an independent appraisal for any gift that is made over $5,000.
You mean a non-cash gift, right?
Yeah, non-cash. I mean, if you're given something like a stock, there's proof of what the value of that stock was on the day the gift was made, because stocks are traded publicly, we know what the value of the gift was. But when you're giving property, collectibles, a piece of art, we don't know what that is. And so you must give an independent appraisal. I've seen, there's been known cases, John, where people have made, let's say, large donations of property, a business or something like that to charity. They didn't get an independent appraisal. The IRS has disallowed the deduction for making the charitable gift. So anytime if you're going to make a non-cash gift over $5,000, you could lose the deduction if you do not have an independent appraisal. And if you're making a large non-cash gift, something like a business, collectible art, any kind of valuable, you know, it could be antiques or historical artifacts, whatever it is, You really want to work with some kind of advisor. What you don't want to do is make this gift, take the deduction, then find out you get audited later on and it's disallowed. You really want to work with your advisor when you're getting into charitable giving, because this is something they monitor very closely. When they look in returns, and especially if it's a large donation, it's going to automatically get kicked and flagged on an IRS audit when they go through your return.
Okay, so that's amounts, non-cash gifts above $5,000. What about gifts of lesser amount? And we're talking here tithes to churches or to charities, used clothing, furniture, things you haul over to Goodwill, something like that.
You know, once again, there's a whole set of rules, as complex as our laws are. If it's less than $250, you could probably get by with a bank record. Less than $500, you could probably get a receipt from your charity or church. That's probably adequate. That'll stand up. If it's over $500, you would need to include the details specifically in Form 8283. They actually have a form for it. And also, here's something that has got a lot of seniors, because at age 70 and a half, you have to start taking mandatory distributions from IRAs. A lot of times, those seniors that are very well off may donate part of their IRA deduction to a charity. Let's say they make a direct transfer of cash or securities to their charity. Remember to exclude that amount of transfers from your total IRA. You better let your accountant know about this. Hey, I took a withdrawal of $200,000 or $100,000 from my IRA, but $50,000 went to my church or it went to the Red Cross. You better note that. And they actually have a line item on your front page of your tax return. It's line item 15B on your 1040 form that you can exclude this. This is basically saying, hey, look, I know my 1099 says I took $100,000 of the IRA, but $50,000 of it went to my church. So you want to make sure you include this and put it in on your line item on the front page of your tax return, because what you don't want to do is have your 1099 say you took out $100,000 when you really gave half of that to a church and the IRS is going to come back and audit you. So you really need to document and cover this when you're making charitable gifts. This is something under the Obama administration they're looking very closely at in auditing.
You know, you never know whether you should laugh or cry at this, because the rules have become so complex.
Probably do a lot of crying.
I just know every year when we get done with our income tax return, we sign at the bottom, you know, under penalty of perjury. I have no idea whether this is all in conformity to all these rules or not. You know, I mean, when you even have a professional do it, you can't be sure of that. And we know that because every year, what is it? What foundation gives a moderate tax return, not a super complex one, not a simple one. They give a moderate tax return for a middle-class income family, and they give it to like 25 different CPAs or tax attorneys and say, and they pay them, just like a client would, prepare this tax return. Not two of them get the same answer. I mean, this is how absurdly different the whole thing is, depending on which of these multi-complex laws that you refer to. Even the experts have difficulty in figuring the rules. Now, imagine, you know, people that can't afford a lot of counsel in this area, parents, students, individuals. It's just absolutely a nightmare now, and Congress knows it, and they don't do anything about it.
You know, it actually gets more complex than that, because a lot of people, especially when it comes to, like, for example, state tax refunds, a lot of people pay in, they have money taken out of their paycheck for state taxes, which you can claim a deduction for the taxes you pay, property taxes, also state taxes, and certain states you can even deduct sales taxes. They made some exemptions on that. I forget which states that applies to. But here's the problem. If you take the standard deduction and you get a tax refund from the state, no problem. However, if you take itemized deductions and you get a refund from the state on the state taxes you paid, guess what? You now have taxable income. So this gets very, very complicated, because a lot of people take the standard deduction, really not a problem. You itemize deductions, get a refund from the state. Guess what? You owe Uncle Sam some money and you need to report the amount of the refund.
Well, it seems like they're looking even now at getting rid of a lot of things, because let's face it, as governments become bigger and more expansive, they have more expenses. You never hear real serious talk about cutting things back, cutting the expenses back. So the targets here in the income tax thing to raise tax revenues would be getting rid of itemized deductions. And what seems to be happening here is a process of gradualism where they chip away at things so they can get more of taxes every year without people generating this large outcry. The president, President Obama, is talking about getting rid of deductions, limiting pension assets, taxing estates twice at death, raising the capital gains and dividend taxes. These are all trial balloons. They fly them out there and see how much squawking they get. But as they say in Latin, caveat assiduus. I didn't make that one up.
I thought
this
it was
time,
caveat emptor.
No, caveat emptor is the buyer. Assiduus is a taxpayer in Latin. So it's caveat assiduus.
I should have known that. I was an altar boy like you.
Were you really?
Yeah.
I don't think we ever talked about taxpayers in church, though. So far, the president's proposing new taxes every single year. He's gotten his wish in 2010, 2013. Now, any other common traps that we need to advise people about? So if they're doing tax planning, retirement planning, they can benefit from that.
You know, a couple more I think we need to cover here, and that is the AMT tax. That's called the alternative minimum tax. And this is impacting, John, more and more Americans, which is ironic. When it was first put into play, it was done to sort of go after wealthy people that claim large tax deductions with tax shelters. Over the years, they never adjusted the level of which it kicks in, and it's grabbing more and more middle-class Americans. And this applies really to individuals that have many itemized deductions. There may be a reason. You have a big mortgage expense, you have medical expenses, you pay a lot in state taxes, like if you live in California, Hawaii, or some of the high-tax states. And what you may not be aware of is your accountant or the government does two calculations on your tax return. The regular tax deduction with your itemized deductions and one where they exclude some of your itemized deductions. And the exemption amount from alternative minimum tax is very low. And here's the problem. They haven't adjusted these figures for inflation that much. For single, the exemption is $52,800. For married, it's $82,100. And if your AMT tax is larger than your regular income tax, you pay the AMT tax, which is a rate of 28%. So be careful if you have a lot of itemized deductions in one year. And usually these are things like mortgage interest, state taxes, property taxes, maybe large charitable contributions, or let's say medical expenses. Because what happens is they can come back to bite you. And, you know, these are the kind of things, John, these are sort of what I call the gotcha moments when you're meeting with your accountant and you're thinking, you know, when you're putting your taxes together, you're taking a look at your mortgage expense, what you paid in state taxes, property taxes, all your itemized deductions. You're thinking, oh, good, I can reduce my taxable income. And then your accountant says, oh, by the way, you owe extra money. In a lot of cases, for I think this is going to affect maybe 30 million Americans for 2014, it's the AMT tax.
What about FACTA laws? We've talked about this during the weekend program quite a bit. That went into effect as well in 2014. Maybe we need to look at that as well.
You know, this is a real tax hazard, and especially for individuals that have either they're working overseas, global ties, or global assets, they face probably, John, some of the worst scrutiny and some of the worst tax hazards. In fact, this is so complex. I mean, I don't want to cover it here because we would really need to be speaking with somebody like a Mark Nessman, a tax attorney. But let's say this. If you have assets overseas, work overseas, you could face stiff fines and penalties that are actually confiscatory. And the IRS under Obama has gotten very aggressive in this category. What you really need, you need to download forms 8938 and 3520 and read them. My advice, if you have overseas assets, bank accounts, storing bullion overseas, any interest income, or you work overseas, hire a tax expert. This gets very complex. You can not only face fines, but if the government thinks you're willfully trying to hide your income, you could face imprisonment as well. It's complex. It's bothersome. In fact, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week that more and more Americans that are living overseas are giving up their citizenship because last year, and this is reported by the Treasury Department, 3,415 Americans gave up their citizenship, up 14% from the year before. One of the reasons is the U.S. is unique among developed nations. We're one of the few countries that taxes non-resident citizens. In other words, you're a U.S. citizen living overseas on income earned anywhere in the world, even when subject to double taxation. You could be working in a country where that country taxes your income. Well, guess what? Uncle Sam wants to tax it too. These reporting rules are so onerous. Now, FACTA went into effect in July of 2014, and on top of that, to make matters worse, the Treasury Department last year upped the fee if you want to exit the United States and give up your citizenship. The fee went from $450 to $2,350, so it is so complex. Let me just put it this way. Folks, if you have assets overseas, you're storing bullion, you have investment income, or you're working overseas, do yourself a favor, because the penalties are so stiff in the fines, or even worse, the government thinks you're hiding your income. Well, you could even go to prison. So you really want to get a good tax advisor.
And you probably won't be able to listen to Financial Sense NewsHour if you're in prison. So that's not a good deal.
I don't know. Can you listen to podcasts in prison?
I think that's restricted. I'm not sure. I'd have to check. It probably depends on the prison, you know. Well, okay, let's put some things into practical terms today. The real bottom line here is if you are working overseas, the government's becoming very aggressive in this area. I'm not sure whether it's a political posture for political reasons more than anything else, because I'm not sure how much it really nets. But nevertheless, this is the way it is. These laws are very complicated. You should get professional advice in this. Now, let's move on to what we do is we do a case study. We've been doing this quite frequently here on the program. We take a real life case study. We change the names of the people involved to protect their privacy, and see how well all of the advice we're giving you here on the program actually works. So here we have, drum roll, bum, brum, and the names are?
John and Kathy Clark.
Yay. And John is what, age?
66.
Kathy?
And Kathy, age 64.
Okay.
Now, in the Clark's case, John retired early from a high-tech firm here in San Diego. He got an incentive package. Kathy was an ER nurse. She retired when John retired. They lost some assets in the financial crash, as many people did. That was probably some of the greatest things that we've seen impacting retirement planning, John, was the financial crisis, zero interest rates, quantitative easing, because a lot of people lost assets during the crash. But what ensued afterwards was that the returns on income came down, and especially on investments, that even though people had assets they thought would produce a certain level of income, that doesn't happen. But when you lose money in a stock market crash, as many people did in 2007 to 2009, you become stock market shy, which was the case with the Clarks. And they were primarily invested in cash and bond funds as investors. The problem was the budget wasn't cutting it. They had substantial equity in their home. And here's the issue. They had one of their kids and their grandkids were in Scottsdale, Arizona, and a lot of their friends had left Rancho Bernardo and moved to Arizona, where the taxes were lower, the cost of living was lower. And so this was an issue that they were facing because they were dipping into principal. Their sources of income weren't providing them with the level of income that could cover all of their retirement needs.
So what do their finances look like? I'm assuming that they probably live in California. This might make their major asset, what, their home?
Well, you hit upon a real key issue here, because when we took a look at their balance sheet, they had roughly about $100,000 in CDs and banks, $750,000, that used to be a larger figure, in an IRA between both John and Kathy. Their home in Rancho Bernardo was $1.1 million. They roughly had about a $300,000 mortgage. So they almost had $2 million of assets with about $300,000 in liabilities. So, you know, this is, you know, what we used to, the old saying, what's a millionaire in California? A homeowner. And that's pretty much the case here. Their home was worth about $1.1 million. But if you look at their total assets of not quite $2 million, more than half of it was in the value of their home and substantial equity in that home. So home equity was almost as large as their investment portfolio. Now let's take a look at their sources of income. John's Social Security was $24,000. Kathy's was $18,000. So total income was about $42,000. investments in cash and bonds, roughly a little over 2%, produced about $17,000. So between Social Security and investments, they had $59,000. Let's round it off and say $60,000. The problem was their expenses, including their mortgage payments, living expenses, was $84,000. The shortfall was $25,000. Now, the reason they had a shortfall, as we pointed out going through the planning process, is it was a function of having money in cash and having money in bond funds. And then also they had a mortgage expense. They still had a $300,000 mortgage, and more than half of their assets was tied up, as many couples here in California that have lived here for a number of decades, was tied up in the equity in their home.
So it's obvious that there are a number of factors at play right here. First of all, low interest rates. We've talked about that quite a bit. They didn't seem to have a very good investment mix. Definitely too much equity in their home, although that seems to be typical in California, where, given where the housing market is, that's what happens. Now, what happened as far as planning and trying to direct them in the right direction?
Well, one of the key things here is we tried to point out is, look, over 55% of your assets, almost 60% of your assets, is the value of your home. And one of the things that I think made them disposed with the idea of moving is, number one, they had friends that had moved to Sun City, Arizona. They had their oldest son and their grandchildren from their oldest son was living there. Warm weather. And the only issue would be is, you know, if you live in Arizona during the summer, folks, it's 110, 113 degrees. I grew up there. And they had two issues. Their son that was married with kids lived in Arizona. They had two daughters that lived here, and their best friends had moved to Sun City, Arizona. So the issue was, do you really want to have all this money tied up in one major asset called your home?
And the predicament they have is they want to be close to their kids. But then the other issue here is that just when you think you've situated yourself next to your kids move because they have jobs and career opportunities that may take them somewhere else.
Yeah, and that was the issue. You know, we looked at the fact that they had friends there, their oldest son, their grandchildren were there. And when we took a look at it, you know, do you want to draw down your principal? Nothing that unnerves somebody that's retired when you start drawing down your principal because you're thinking, you know, how long can I live and how long can I keep this up? So they looked at the assets, the equity in their home, and they agreed to sell their home. It was much cheaper. Well, in fact, anything is cheaper than living in California because I don't care if it's food, gasoline, housing, taxes, whatever it is, it's more expensive here. They sold their home not quite for $1.1 million. They sold it for about $1.05 million. In less selling costs, they netted close to $1 million. And then, of course, they had to pay off the mortgage. So they walked away with about $700,000 of equity. They bought a home in Sun City West. It was about 1,900 square feet for about $172,000. They spent about $30,000 in upgrades with kitchens, bathrooms, and they did a number of things. Number one, by getting rid of the home, they got rid of a $1,500 house payment. Number two, property taxes dropped to $1,000. Sun City, Arizona has a special property tax rate. You don't have to pay for school districts versus the $13,000 they were paying for their home in RB. The combination cut monthly expenses by almost $2,500 a month. That was a savings of $30,000 a year. Now, the budget now was $54,000 versus $84,000 by reducing property taxes and housing payment because they paid cash for their home. Secondly, they were in a lower income tax bracket. Anybody that lives in California, you make about $50,000, $60,000, you're in a 9.3% bracket. Now we had an additional $500,000 that we had to invest in the portfolio. We left $100,000 that they had previously in cash. That was just their comfort level for safety. We took $750,000 of the IRA, the $500,000 we got from the home equity. Now we had a $1.25 million portfolio producing income versus a $750,000. $750,000 went into bonds at 4%. That was $30,000 of income. And roughly $500,000 went into stocks at 3%. That was 15. So now we had $45,000 of income, but we did increase their budget because basically they still had two daughters that lived in California. You don't want to live in Phoenix during the summer months. So they were able to attain a 3-month lease on a condo for roughly about $6,500 a month here in Del Mar. You know, so that added roughly about almost $20,000 to the budget. The new budget was almost $74,000. New income was $87,000, John. They had roughly about a $14,000 surplus, which allowed for travel, other expenses. And here was a case. There was a couple things here. Number one, it was called the tax inversion. By moving from California, 9.3% tax bracket, they moved to Arizona, 2.5% tax bracket. They moved from a property tax rate of 1.25% to a tax rate that was about 0.5%. Instead of a house worth $1.1 million, they moved to a house that was roughly, with upgrades, a little over $200,000, paid for, free and clear. And so a lot of this was basically saving taxes, getting rid of a mortgage payment, cutting property taxes, income taxes. Cost of living overall went down dramatically. And that tax savings was so great, and also freeing up that equity, they had the best of both worlds. They could spend most of the year in Arizona with their son and living a lifestyle that was much less expensive than what they had in California. And during the summer months, they had enough money that they could rent a place here in Del Mar and be with their two daughters that lived here in San Diego and be out of the summer heat of Arizona and still have some surplus. So it was using the equity in the home and then also using the tax savings and moving to a state with a lower cost of living.
So once again, by making wise decisions based on a good plan, they were able to reduce significantly their tax burdens and find a decent place to live that didn't carry as much weight and restriction in terms of taxes. So it was a successful story. Now, coming up next, we have Dr. David Sayin, who is Regional Administrator for Medicare in California, Arizona, Hawaii, and elsewhere in parts of the West, part of Lifetime Income as it continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Puflava or his Lifetime Income Specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Increasingly, for many seniors, Medicare plays an important role in health care. So today we're going to discuss Medicare. What does it cover? What does it cost? And what does it not cover? Joining me on the program is David Sayin. He's Medicare's Regional Administrator for California, Arizona, Hawaii, Nevada, and the Pacific Territories. Hello, David, and welcome back to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Dave, let's talk today about Medicare, and I guess maybe the best place to start out, what does it and what does it not cover for seniors?
Well, Medicare is our government health care program for folks who are 65 of age or older, as well as some younger folks who are permanently disabled. And the Medicare program pays for a variety of medical services and goods in hospitals, doctor's offices, and other settings, but it does not cover everything, and it is useful to know what is and is not included.
So if you take a look at what's included and what's not included, how does this coverage work? For example, I know Medicare has different parts. Maybe we can talk about these four parts running from A to D.
Sure. So most services are covered under Medicare Part A or Medicare Part B. And if you have both of those, which most people with Medicare do, you're going to get those services. You can find out if you have both parts A and B by looking at your actual Medicare card. And if you have original Medicare, you're going to use that card to get your services. If you choose to join one of the Medicare private health plans, then you'll be using a card from the plan to get your services.
What does Medicare Part A cover, David?
Under the law, Medicare Part A is actually called hospital insurance, and it pays for inpatient care in hospitals, as well as inpatient care in some cases in skilled nursing facilities and some hospice and home health services.
Can you just touch upon briefly some of the nursing services? Because I think there's a misconception that if you go into long-term care, it's covered permanently by Medicare. I don't believe that's the case.
That's correct. Medicare only pays for skilled nursing stays or rehabilitation after a three-day hospital stay when you're receiving active treatment that is intended to return you, restore your health. An individual who needs to reside in a medical facility permanently or for a very long time, Medicare is not a program to cover that residential need.
All right. Let's move on then to Part B, which is the medical insurance part. What does that take care of?
So Part B takes care of your physician visits, outpatient care, home health services for the most part, and medical equipment that you need, as well as some preventive services like vaccinations, tests for cancer or heart problems, and so forth. And those services are not just for sickness, but we're trying to keep you healthy there and detect disease at an early stage when it's treatable.
Okay. Well, then let's talk about the cost, because obviously you have to pay something for this coverage. What does Part A cost someone with Medicare? And are there different costs, David, based on income brackets?
Well, Part A, hospital insurance, is the entitlement program in Medicare. So the great majority of people don't pay a premium. What we do is we pay payroll taxes during the years that we work. And if we've worked enough years, then when we're eligible for Medicare, we get Part A. It's at no cost to us. Some people, if you're a legal resident, for example, that did not work in our system, can buy into Part A. So when you have Part A, there is a deductible. So the first $1,260 you're going to pay out of pocket if you go in the hospital, let's say. And that's per benefit period. So if you actually were out of the hospital for 60 days and went in the hospital for something else, you could have a second deductible in a given year. And then after that, the first 60 days in the hospital are completely covered.
And the cost or coverage for Part B then?
So Part B, supplemental medical insurance, does have a monthly premium. And generally speaking, that monthly premium is keyed to 25% of the cost of the program. So roughly 25% of the cost of the program is borne by beneficiaries paying premium. The other three quarters are borne by the rest of the folks who are paying taxes. So that monthly premium for most people is $104.90 for 2015. For some higher income people, it does go up a bit. And there is a deductible. So the first $147 you have to pay out of pocket, then the program will pay 20% of the Medicare approved amount for services. And there's no limit on the out of pocket expense there.
Now, you mentioned preventive health services. What's the out of pocket cost for those?
Well, because of language in the Affordable Care Act, there are no co-payments for preventive services from a qualified provider who accepts Medicare. There are some where you may have a deductible or co-insurance, so you need to ask. But for the most part, that's the case. And that would include things like vaccination for the flu, colorectal or breast or prostate cancer screening, cardiovascular disease screening, even counseling to talk to your doctor about stopping smoking or stopping using alcohol. And it includes your one-time welcome to Medicare visit with your doctor in your first year in Part B, where you can review your medical history and kind of make a plan for where you're going in your life in terms of preventive screenings and lifestyle. And then after that, there's an annual wellness visit that we'll pay for, again, to update your plan to prevent disease or disability and manage your health going forward.
David, what about, I know sometimes Medicare will only cover so much of a procedure or stay or something like that. Can we talk a little bit about supplemental Medicare insurance?
I knew you would ask about that. Well, we mentioned before that Medicare does not cover long-term care in a nursing facility, custodial care. Important thing to know. You can buy insurance for that, but it's not Medicare. Also, Medicare doesn't cover dental or vision care, dentures, cosmetic surgery, and it doesn't cover acupuncture or hearing aids or the exams for those. That's important to know.
All right, so let's go over the things that Medicare does not cover.
For those things that Medicare doesn't cover, that I mentioned, hearing aids, eyeglasses, and so forth, those are things that you're going to pay for out of pocket. Now, earlier you mentioned Medicare supplemental insurance, what people often call Medigap insurance. Lots of people who are in the original Medicare program with Part A and B choose to purchase private Medigap insurance, and that helps them deal with those deductibles and copayments.
And are there any restrictions on that in terms of coverage? Are there any limitations on that?
There are some limitations that are important to remember. So when you first come into Medicare, you can get that insurance regardless of your health status, although you may pay more if you have health issues. But if you go without it, you lose that opportunity. And so you can't decide to buy into Medigap later and be guaranteed that you'll be able to get a policy based on your health. So while the Affordable Care Act did away with risk screening and denial of coverage based on health status, that was only for working age folks and people that aren't on Medicare. The Medigap plans still have this opportunity to deny you service based upon your health. So if you want to be a Medicare person with Medigap, you want to sign up when you're first eligible.
So if you need those services, I guess who pays for them?
Well, the eyeglasses, the dental, that stuff, that's out of pocket unless you have access to dental insurance or vision insurance. I know that some working age people do. And then when it comes to long-term care or custodial care, some people have insurance for that. Some people pay for it. And some people who have modest means get help from state Medicaid programs to help pay for that.
Now, you talk about the Medicare health plan. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, this is an important distinction. So the expression Medicare Part C refers to a program that we have that about 30% of the people in Medicare take advantage of, where rather than using their traditional Medicare benefit, they sign on with a health plan, a private health plan like an HMO or a PPO that we have a relationship with. And in those arrangements, generally, you're going to be limited to doctors and hospitals that the plan has an arrangement with, and you may pay more if you go outside of that. That's the thing you got to watch.
And what is something that they refer to as Medicare Advantage plans?
Medicare Advantage is the term of art that was introduced in the Medicare Modernization Act back in 2003 that refers to these private plans that we have a relationship with. So that's what Medicare Part C is. Those plans are technically called Medicare Advantage plans, although obviously they have a variety of different trade names that they use in the marketplace.
Now, since this is sort of outside the service, what kind of cost structure does this involve?
Well, those Medicare Advantage plans receive a premium from the government based upon your choosing that plan for them to cover services for you. You'll need to have Part B to take advantage of that program. And many of these plans will have some additional premium for which oftentimes they may offer some additional services that you don't get under original Medicare, perhaps help with dental or vision.
And finally, there is a Medicare Part D. Let's talk about that. What is it and what does it do?
Well, that's very important. Part D is our prescription drug program, which started back in 2006. For people that are in those Part C Medicare Advantage private plans, they generally have drug coverage wrapped into it. But for people that are sticking with the original Medicare Part A and B program, they can buy a drug insurance plan under Medicare Part D. That plan will have its own premiums, and it helps you pay for prescription drugs. Typically those that are on their list of covered drugs, what they call a formulary. And different drugs may have different prices in different plans. And so when people think about Medicare Part D, they need to think about what medications they want to get access to.
And how do you find, I guess, a good Part D or Medicare Advantage plan? I'm sure there's probably a lot out in the marketplace, but where do you get information on plans that are offered out there? Because like anything else, whether you're buying car insurance, buying life insurance, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of plans out there, but what's the right one and what's the best cost?
Well, you're right about a lot of choice, and that's particularly true in Southern California, where there are a lot of great plans to choose from. We recommend people use our Medicare website. It's called medicare.gov, and there's a big old green button that says Find Health and Drug Plans, and it'll show you those plans that are available where you live and tell you about their premiums and their deductibles, and even it has ratings in the form of 1 to 5 stars about how good these plans are.
And I know that websites are very helpful today. I mean, who doesn't use the internet when you want to find out about something? But what about folks who don't have computers? Maybe they live in an area where they don't have internet coverage. If they want to talk to, let's say, a live human being and get help, what do you do?
We have operators around the clock at our toll-free number, which is 1-800-MEDICARE, 633-4227 are the numbers there. And those 1-800-MEDICARE folks have access to all this information, and they'd be more than happy to give you some counseling and talk about what plans might be the best choices for you. Now, also here in California, we have a program called the Health Insurance Counseling and Advocacy Program, or HICAP. They actually offer face-to-face counseling. You could meet them maybe at a senior center or the library. They put on public events, and these people are volunteers that we have trained. So they're not selling anything. They're volunteers. Most of them are beneficiaries themselves. A lot of them are retired professionals, and they can give you some unbiased information. And they live in your community, so they know about the plans that are in your community that are good. So you can get to them if you call our 1-800-MEDICARE number, tell them where you live, and they can help you find a counselor.
David, what about seniors, let's say an individual or a couple that is in the low income category? Is there any help for them paying their Medicare costs?
There is. First off, for those folks of limited means that want to purchase that prescription drug insurance, there's a program that generally save people up to around $4,000 a year who qualify for it. It's called Extra Help. The people at the Social Security Administration actually administer that program, but 1-800-MEDICARE can connect you with those. And it looks at how much money you have, how much income do you have. In many cases, it can help you pay for your drugs. And then there's also some programs that are administered by the state under the Medi-Cal program that help people pay for their Medicare premiums and deductibles too. So that's something you might want to also explore.
David, once again, if somebody would like to find out information, would you suggest that they go to the Medicare site itself where most of this information is collated? I know you, likewise with Social Security, there's a very helpful site from signing up. Can you sign up for Medicare on your site?
Yes, you can sign up for Medicare. You can enroll in a health plan. You can do everything. But what I really want people out there who are listening to the radio, who are the type of people that like to do things verbally, to remember that we do have people that you can talk to on the phone at 1-800-MEDICARE, and we do have volunteers in your community where you can sit down with your pill bottles and your Medicare explanation of benefits things and figure out if you need to do something different to save money.
Well, listen, David, I appreciate you coming back on the program and keeping our listeners up to date. Once again, Medicare.gov. Medicare.gov is a place you want to go to get information, and there's plenty of phone numbers. And David, would you give out the most relevant phone number to get help or counseling?
Yes, the easiest thing is our 1-800-MEDICARE operators, and the numbers spell out 1-800-MEDICARE on your phone or 800-633-4227.
David, as always, thanks for coming on the program. All the best to you, sir, and come back and talk to us again.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income. Once again, whether you are eligible for Medicare or you're eligible for Social Security, highly recommend you go to the government sites. Gosh, it's sure better than trying to make an appointment, get a visit in the long time delays. I know with signing up for Social Security, you can do that probably within 15 minutes. You can also find out your benefits. Likewise with Medicare. So do take advantage of these sites. They're helpful and may answer a lot of questions you may have regarding whether it's Social Security or Medicare. They're there to help you. On behalf of John Leffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on this week's Lifetime Income series. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.